jobbers you lost out more often than not, rather than were the beneficiaries of the operations of the shops?
I'd say basically we're beneficiaries.
In what ways?
Well, when the market was rising, you could always get stock. Then, of course, they used to support it a bit as well. No, not only, they used to, a lot of the shops, the mining houses particularly, Central Mining and people like that used to, when the market was flat, some upset, they'd come in and support the market. A good shop was one that supported a market on a fall. A bad shop was one that didn't support it.
And you as a jobber, say, in the cafe market in the late 40s, did you have a pretty clear idea who was who in terms of who were the shop brokers for
particular companies? Oh, yes, you knew.
And was this an important thing for you to know?
Most important. First thing in jobbing is know your customers.
And did the shops continue to operate right through your jobbing career, or did they gradually disappear?
I think in the mining market, they always operated. Always. But the West African market just died a death. They couldn't operate anymore.
Now, were the characteristics of the other markets that you began to deal in, the stores or electrics, for example, were they very different to the kaffir?
The same principles applied. You see, I remember when I was dealing in AEI and General Electric, that the shop broker, the results came out in March, and the shop broker used to come round about the middle of January, whatever he wanted to do. If he was a buyer, I'd run a bull book. If he was a seller, I'd run a bear book. And then the results come out in March.
And were the actual broad characteristics of the market in terms of the way you jobbed and the kind of factors influencing the market, whether it went up or down, were they more or less similar to the cafe market?
It's the same in all markets. There's certain sort of hard and fast rules there. For example, if a market's had a big drop and there are no buyers, and a buyer comes along, a fairly substantial buyer, large, reasonable number, you've got a bad book, you've got the stock higher up. If he comes round to buy them, sell him as few as you can get away with. Never deal the first buyer after a fall. All sorts of little principles. Never be a bear in company. In other words, if you're all bears, supposing you've got five market makers, they're all short. One buyer comes in, you've got six buyers. So it's usually wrong to be a bear in company, although you can be a bull in a crowd. You can all be a bull of stock and make money, but if you're all a bear of a stock, unless the company is going to go out, it's usually wrong.
Did you generally have much idea about what your competition were doing on the floor of the house while you were trading?
You had to guess.
How did you go about doing that?
Well, that was one of the most intriguing things of all. You could frequently be wrong as well. Very often, if you were a big seller of stock, the way to sell it was to go and bid for it. If you're a big buyer of a stock, the thing was to go and offer it. So you offered it out openly, but quietly bought.
When you say offered out openly...
Well, you had open cry, you see. You'd go and offer the stock openly. There was a lot of that done.
And that went right until when? When did the open cry, for example, begin to...
Well, when they started, the open cry stopped. When you got the five big jobbers, basically, open cry finished.
Yes. Can you describe any particular... deals that you remember in which you operated in this way?
Well, open cry?
Yes, or open...
Well, I'll give you a good example. When I was in the cafe market, there was a stock called New Union. And there was a very big market, but I rather felt that it was a phony, a and I had stock on the book, a lot of stock on the book, and wanted to sell it. And they were 4.5, 7.5. It was the four, or I think four or five was, I don't know what it was, but they were 5 and 4.5, 7.5. So I went into the market and I knew that one jobber was rather a conceited man, always thought he was the market, and whatever I could do, he could do better. So I rushed into the market like a novice and said, 3.9 in 25,000 new union. So he turned round with a sort of sneer on his face and said, 4.5, 7.5 in 50,000 new union. So I said, silly 50. That was sort of a good example of how, by crying out, you could do business. Or sometimes you go in there with looking very miserable when the market had a bit of a rise, and you take a chance, you go and bid openly for it. You only bid openly because you hope someone bid a bit more. When they bid a bit more, bang, straight away. You'd sell them.
Yes.
And you never had a query in your bargains. I mean, there's all those sort of skills that one could use. So it was sometimes very difficult to know what your opposition was up to. If you didn't know, you were cautious. But if you smelled it out, but if you, another thing was this thing called spoiling. Supposing you found out that one of your competitors was a buyer of stock and had an order there to buy stock. You had no business. And then you deliberately bid over his price just to stop him doing his business. That was known as spoiling. That was quite common. Mm-hmm. Or they might see you, there was a lot of lip reading done. So someone would come round to me and say, "Oh, what a Ramfantine. A lot of argy-bargy, 4.5. So he bought, say, quite a few, so in those days, a tenner. So you'd sell 10,000 to Semper-Sapney. They wait till you're gone, they see you book the bargain, say, no, you're dealt. Then they bid Semper-Sapney for them, deliberately to spoil.
So that meant that there was a lot of bad feeling or hostility between jobbers?
No, it was only when these people spoilt one another, then it'd soon be forgotten, but so-and-so spoilt me. Mm. And then you watch out for him, you see.
What were relations between jobbers like generally?
Basically very friendly.
Did you see particularly each other outside of the house?
I beg your pardon?
Did you see each other outside of the house?
Not a lot, really. No, not a lot. Mm. Saw enough of one another all day long.
Could you describe what a typical day was like for you, perhaps if we pick, say, arbitrarily the mid-1950s?
Well, you'd
starting from
the
journey into work.
Well, you'd study the papers and that sort of thing, and then you'd come in, and I think it might be easier, or you'd say, or better, and then you'd they'd come round to you, what a so-and-so, you'd make them a price.
Who would come round to you?
Brokers would come round, and they'd come round asking the prices, and then someone would deal. If you knew he was a hot merchant, say you'd say, that's a wrong un, and you'd alter your price drastically. You might say, well, that's all right, and wouldn't alter your price, or even call it lower or better, but you wouldn't worry, but you just carried on dealing, and it went on all day long.
Did you stop at some point for lunch?
Yes, you'd have. Well, I used to go out about half an hour.
What would you have for lunch? Would you?
I used to go up into my office and have a sandwich there because it was, you know, too much pushing and shoving in these bars and places.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do when you'd finished dealing on the floor of the house?
Went up to the office and worked out your profit and loss, mm-hmm. and your amount you were bull of and the amount you were bear of.
Mm. Were they fairly long days?
No, I'd say we started about 9:30, 9:15. and finished at house closed at 4, you'd pack up at 5, 5:15.
And would you have any contact with brokers after hours? Would they come in, visit the office, or would they
No.
Ring by phone, no contact at all?
No, just a ring up.
And did you have any contact with journalists? Either as
oh yes, the journalists would come on and ask what was doing, why so-and-so were better, and what the closing price is, and were there any rumours about this? They used to ring up in the evening, every night.
Were the journalists a source of information for you, or was generally the traffic the other way around?
The other way around. Yeah, very much the other way around. They asked us. That's why nowadays the market reports are basically market makers' reports.
Yes. What I wanted to know is ask you about particular events in stock exchange history from the post-war period, just to see if you have any particular memories you associate with those times. And if you don't,
yes, well,
don't worry.
I can remember one thing very vividly. I remember it was in the Kaffa market. That must have been 1953. Mm. We were dealing away there, and all of a sudden, someone came and said, "The king's dead." And you could have heard a pin, all of a sudden, right through the whole stock exchange, you could have heard a pin drop. We're all dealing, all of a sudden it was dead quiet, not a whistle. You could have heard a pin drop. Just by, carried by word of mouth. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning, I think. Someone came, oh, the king's died. It was George VI. And it, you know, it struck me as being absolutely extraordinary. Everybody stopped dealing.
Did they stop dealing for the whole day?
No, no, and then a little while, and then dealings started quietly again. But for quite a few minutes, you could, it was not a whisper.
You said earlier on that you had a few reservations about going back into the stock exchange after the war because there was a Labour government in office. Did the nationalisations affect the stock exchange or affect firms?
I think they basically
lost their business.
I think basically they made money. They made money out of nationalisation.
In what way?
Well, the people were selling their, you know, steel and that sort of thing. Mm. That was the biggest one I remember. It was quite a very big business. Mm.
Mm. So the jobbers made money.
Yes. But steel shares in particular, I think it was a, you know, was the prices they took them over, gave gilts for it.
Yes. Did the first big devaluation, and I think it must have been around 1949.
Oh yes, there was quite a lot of business after that.
Yes.
Very big business.
Yes. Again, do you have any particular memories associated with that time?
Yes, well, they closed the stock exchange and everybody dealt out in the street.
Did that make dealing difficult, or
no,
you just simply got on with it?
Yeah, you got on with it, because certain people in certain markets just grouped here and others grouped somewhere else. Mm. No traffic could get through in Throgmorton Street.
Were there other occasions when you found yourself dealing on the street?
There used to be, in the old days, there was a street market every night in Shorter's Court in American stocks. Mm. And there were, just after the war, there used to be, you used to send your book up at 4 o'clock or whenever you packed up in the house, and then you had a little street market in Kaffa shares until then there was nothing doing, you drifted to your office.
Do you have any particular memories of that occasion when you were dealing on the street in 1949 after the devaluation? What effect did it have on the values of stocks?
Well, the values of stocks went up, fixed went down, particularly there was a boom in gold shares. Because the price of gold jumped pro rata the devaluation of the pound. Mm.
So in fact you found it quite a lucrative
decision. Yes, very much so.
Mm. Mm. How was the market doing generally after the war?
What, immediately after the war?
Well, during the late 40s.
Not much business. No. It was hard. So you could get a living, that was about all, and it wasn't easy.
Mm. I believe it was around 1953 when there was the first post-war stock exchange boom, and rationing was
the business started about that time when Claw and Wolfson started taking over stocks. They were the first people to spot the undervaluation, particularly of property. And there was a big business done in sort of property shares, land securities, you know, was land securities stood at pence. I forget, it was stock conversion, I think, was the stock, the shell that land securities started from, or something like that. And they virtually stood at coppers. And now capitalised at billions.
Do you have any experiences that you associate with that first post-war boom as a dealer?
Yes, it was very pleasant. It was good business, and we were probably working till late in the office, because in those days the staff would always stay late to get up to date. They got some overtime, they wanted the money.
What about the devaluation again in 1957 when the...
That wasn't so good. That was the Callaghan one, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, that wasn't so good. That was expected.
Yes, that was 57. It was the pound was devalued from 280 to 240, and there was a Conservative government.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. That was a much tamer affair.
Mm. Mm. Again, do you have any particular memories of the day that occurred?
Well, everybody seemed to know it was going to happen before it happened. That was, if I remember right, it was a bit of a damp squib.
Mm-hmm. Why was that? Do you think people had...
They should have done it before, you see. They hummed and hawed about it and didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, getting on towards the end of that decade, you have some of the first of the big famous takeover battles, the struggle over British Aluminium, and then...
Oh, yes, Pamela Gordon, I think, were the operators in British Aluminium. I remember that. Of course, what they did then, they just bought... There was none of this 5%, 10%, 15%, etc. You just went in and... What you did, you went in and bought the stock until you got sufficient and then made your bid.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you as jobbers, again, involved in any of these takeover...
The one I most remember vividly was when General Electric took over AEI. And I was in the minority and backed General Electric. But the establishment, the Blue Bloods, backed AEI, I backed General. And I used to go and see Hill Samuel were acting for Weinstock. And I used to go and see them in the evening and tell them what was going on. And Greenwell were acting for... AEI, they sent people out in the country wooing everybody to not to accept General's bid and all that sort of lark, and General won. Mm-hmm. But
you say you backed the wrong side.
No, I backed the right. I was in a minority, but I backed the right side.
How did that happen? Did you simply
make a calculation? I thought that that General Electric was a fair bid to everybody, and I thought AEI was a bit of a stodgy company. Lord Chandos was, I believe, then the chairman, and it was a very blue-blooded sort of affair, whereas Weinstock was young and aggressive and forward-looking.
Mm. And what were your role as jobbers? What was your role as a jobber during a takeover like this?
Well, you... people came along and said, oh, what do you do? And you'd say, back Weinstock, and... You know, they'll come along all day long. What do you think? You say, well, I think put your money on Weinstock. And you were obviously dealing and buying stock. And if you got any stock to offer, you offered it to the Weinstock camp, not the other camp. Mm-hmm. As you bought stock, you offered it over to Weinstock.
Did you have cases, now thinking of takeovers in general terms again, where... jobbers would be working too closely with brokers?
I think there were cases of it, yes.
Yes. Now again, without necessarily mentioning particular names, how did that work? Would the broker contact the jobber and let him in on what was going on, and they'd coordinate things?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. And was that a frequent occurrence or an infrequent occurrence?
I think it happened quite a lot. Particularly, I mean, it's the bigger people that did it, of course.
Now, you said at some point you began to feel that capital was a problem, or at least that your
very big problem,
was thinking of retirement.
Yeah.
When did you first begin to feel that was the case?
Well, obviously, with the institutions being the major shareholders, it gradually, you had to be prepared to deal in much bigger amounts. Yes. Unless you, and in dealing in bigger amounts, you had to have a bigger and bigger capital. Yes. And I was beginning to think that, I forget what our capital was in those days. We could always raise money various ways in addition to our own money. But it looked to me as though you, in order to be a real force in the market, you had to have a fairly large capital.
And about when would you say this was the case?
I'd say 1966. I'd say about 1960.
Yes.
60 to 65. But some people did very well out of it because Esmond Durlacher, he said he wanted young men under 25 or 28, some age like that, who could put up £20,000 and he'd make them partners, because he wanted, when he went and his generation went, he wanted younger people to have some capital in order to carry on the firm. Well, I know I have three young chaps who had wealthy fathers. They weren't particularly bright jobbers, and they put £20,000 in. I suppose it must have been about 58, sometime like that. And they all became partners. As a result of that, when they sold out to Barclays Bank, they took out millions.
That was a shrewd investment.
Well, let me put it this way. Napoleon said he didn't want clever generals, he wanted lucky generals.
Now, when was it that you began to seriously think about shutting down Donaldson & Co?
Well, I thought about it when it was obvious to me that one either had to merge with somebody, or, which I wasn't keen on, or increase the capital. And when the joint partner, Burton Parker, who's been retired now 20 years or so, said he wanted to retire, I said, well, I'm not going to carry on alone.
So you then, but you felt you wanted to continue on the floor of the house?
Yes.
Jobbing.
So I went for a while with Sanborn, but there's nothing, if you've been your own governor, it's very difficult to knuckle under a new regime.
When was that? When did you go in with Sanborn?
I think it must have been 1965, somewhere around that area.
And how did you go about managing that? Was it through personal contacts?
Well, I believe they're in the same boat. Mm. They took me in because I put capital in. Mm.
Did you take your books with you also?
No. And when I got there, I found I was given all the duff. what it was, they're all companies where there were five dealers in the stock, and it was very small capital, so you had very little chance of making any money. Mm. What the most profitable book was the food book, where there were only three jobbers and there was very large capitals, AB Foods and things like that.
Yes. What kind of capital had you required to run a book with Donaldson & Co. just before you'd shut the firm down?
200,000.
For each book?
No, for the whole lot.
The whole lot. What about for an individual book?
50,000. Depends on the amount of business, but I think 250,000 capital. Because you could get quite good arrangements with the bank.
What kind of arrangements?
Well, we could borrow stock on a collateral basis. You know, we could borrow up to about a million, I think it was.
And what was your book when you moved over to Sanborn? What market was it?
Electric shares.
Mm. And what kind of capital did you then have to?
Well, on that book, it varied. If it was in a falling market, you didn't want any capital at all. Mm. If you had a big takeover, or you had switch positions, you wanted quarter million, half million. Mm.
And was it fairly easy to increase the amount of capital that you required for a book? Was it something you discussed with your partners?
Oh, yes.
And how did you actually find melding in with the existing partnership in Sanborn? Was it a difficult experience?
It was it was quite friendly and all the rest of it, but I had a very big position in something that's made quite a lot of money on, and they said, oh, we don't want this. I remember it was very interesting. I was dealing with a stock called National Carbonisation, and they took over a stock called Barrow Barnsley, and I was doing a big switch position. I was buying National Carbonisation and selling Barrow Barnsley against it, buying Barrow Barnsley rather, and selling Net Carb against it, making a certain profit, assuming the deal went through. So I realised it was getting a bit big, so I hit on a bright idea, and I went over to Derlac, who had greater capital facilities myself, and suggested we go joint. So they said, yes, we'll do that, because they dealt in Barrow Barnsley, you see, and I dealt in Nat Carb. So they agreed to finance it. Well, anyhow, went on and did enormous business. And so I went up to the office one day and we're all sitting around. I said, hello, they're after something. So they said to me, you mustn't do any more national carbonisation. I said, what's the trouble? They said, well, what happens if the deal doesn't go through? I said, you lose a lot of money. So they said, well, it's a bit dangerous. And I said, oh, no. I said, not dangerous at all. They said, why not? I said, well, the position we've got now joint with Derlac, we've got over 51% of national carbonisation. And I said, we're not going to vote the thing not to go through.
Were there any other similar cases like that?
No, I got a bit browned off because one chap was making a lot of money and I was doing very badly, or not making much, making a few bob, keeping my head above water, but every stock I had was ones that they'd been there for years and couldn't make a profit on. They gave me all these stocks.
Mm-hmm. How would you contrast Sanborn as a firm with Donison?
I think it was, about level, nothing in it. Probably they were more conservative or less speculative than myself, but as a whole. Mm. They had a good business in foods and South African industrials that really kept them going. Mm. But the partners, senior partners, were a bit unimaginative.
Was it an old partnership?
Yes, they were getting on a bit, and the firms that had old partners and wanted to hang on what money they got in that period were all on their way out.
Did you sense that the stock exchange was changing?
Oh yes, very much so.
And in what ways? In what ways did you sense it? And in what ways was it changing?
Well, it was changing into bigger units for a start. And it was obviously the market was going to be dominated by institutional business as opposed to public business. Mm-hmm. You see, and if an institution comes along and they get round, there's a big seller around, there's $250,000 this or $250,000 that, and the fact that people know about it, as I've told you, in the city it's so close, that induces other sellers. So if you take $250,000 shares, you've got to take another $250,000 as well. If you're not prepared to take the second $250,000, you don't take the first. So you've got to have a very large capital.
And so Sanborn began to experience similar problems to the ones that you'd experienced?
Basically, yes.
So,
same problem.
So how did the firm manage? Did you
well? Eventually, Sanborn, they wanted to get their money out, so they packed up, and most of them went to Smith New Court.
Mm. And about when did that happen?
About a year after I left them.
Which was
about 68, I'd say, 68, 69.
And you said that you then went into broking.
Yes.
Did you find it difficult to make a decision to in a sense, come full circle and return to the broking side of single capacity?
No, I used to deal basically on my own account as far as I was concerned, and I had a few accounts that I looked after. But it was a much more relaxed business altogether. See, I never took on any business that was bigger than I couldn't, finance myself, or non-institutional business and all that sort of lark, so I never had any worries. Mm.
Did you feel your long experience as a jobber helped you now as a broker?
Very much so.
In what ways?
Well, I knew the market. I mean, I can, when I've got young blokes around me and they're dealing, and they ask, and I can tell almost immediately by the way they act and behave what their position is or what they want to do. I'm not always right, but usually. I mean, they say they're 80 to 5 all around the market. Six people, and I said, well, go on, ask so-and-so. I said, look, they're sellers, bid them 83, you'll get them. Whereas they'd gone on dealt at 85.
One final event in the life of the stock exchange I want to ask you about is the move from the old house to the new house. Do you think that was a significant event in the history of the stock exchange?
Yes, that meant basically that was the end of a lot of the etiquette, high standards. I think that, I didn't realise at the time, but looking back,